This is the EMDocs.net podcast with Britt Long and Manny Singh. We bring you high-yield content about what you're seeing every day in the ED.
Welcome back to the EMDocs.net podcast. I'm your host, Britt Long, and today I'm back with Jess Pelletier. Jess is an EM Education Fellow at Washington University in St. Louis. Welcome back, Jess.
Thanks, Britt. Happy to be here.
Today, we're going to cover a fairly uncommon pathology that can have serious consequences, spontaneous cervical artery dissection. And for the both of us, we're just going to call it SCAD to make this easier. Jess, let's start off with a definition. What exactly is this?
So SCAD refers to a tear or separation of arterial wall layers involving either the carotid or vertebral arteries. This separation creates a false lumen where blood may enter the vessel wall between the intima and the media or between the media and the adventitia.
None of that sounds good. What can happen when that dissection takes place?
One of a few things, Britt. First, an intramural hematoma can form, and subintimal dissection can cause luminal stenosis and occlusion. Thromboembolism can lead to stroke as well, and this is actually a more common cause of stroke in the setting of SCAD than the hypoperfusion. Lastly, an aneurysm or hematoma can occur and lead to compression of surrounding nerves and other vasculature.
So ischemia, hypoperfusion, compression are the major problems. Who are we going to see this in?
Yeah, good question. This is a common cause of strokes in young people. SCAD actually accounts for 15 to 24% of strokes in patients less than 45. It's a rare cause of stroke overall, only about 2 per 100,000 people for internal carotid artery dissection and 1 per 100,000 individuals for vertebral artery dissection, with combined cases making up about 3 per 100,000. There doesn't seem to be a sex predilection, but multiple dissections at once are more common in women for whatever reason. Risk factors include connective tissue disorders like fibromuscular dysplasia or Ehlers-Danlos, as well as vascular disease.
Thankfully, like you said, it's rare overall, but we need to think about it in the patient who's younger and has stroke-like symptoms. Spontaneous is in the name, but what do you mean by this?
So most cases occur with a mechanical trigger, and many patients won't recall an inciting event, and they're unaware of any major risk factors that lead to the vascular injury and dissection.
Yeah, so interesting naming of this condition. I wouldn't exactly call it spontaneous if there was a mechanical trigger, but that's the convention here. Jess, how do these patients usually present?
Britt, many of these patients will have no symptoms or just local symptoms like neck pain or headache, which is typically on the same side as the dissection. Thankfully for us, the headache or neck pain will usually be anterior if the patient has carotid dissection and posterior if the patient has vertebral artery dissection. Usually local symptoms will be sudden in onset. We can also see partial Horner syndrome, where the patient has ptosis and meiosis, but no anhidrosis, in patients with carotid dissection specifically. Cranial neuropathies can happen due to compression of the nerve fibers, usually cranial nerves 12 or 11, and pulsatile tinnitus is one other red flag.
Definitely a range of symptoms here, but especially unilateral neck pain or headache. Look for that partial Horner syndrome, the cranial neuropathies. You had mentioned cerebral hypoperfusion and thromboembolism. So what about stroke? How can we distinguish that from the cranial neuropathies?
Great question, Britt. So non-stroke cranial neuropathies should really only involve cranial nerves 12 or 11, the ones in the neck that travel near the carotid. But if we see cranial neuropathies involving other nerves, then we should be more suspicious for a central process like stroke or TIA. Monocular blindness, unilateral extremity weakness, and sensory changes can be seen with carotid dissection, since this should affect the anterior circulation. And vertigo, dysmetria, ataxia, diplopia, nausea, vomiting, or vision changes should be seen with vertebral dissection, since this should affect the posterior circulation.
That's helpful with the specific cranial nerves to look out for. Can you also see extremity symptoms with patients who have a vertebral dissection?
Yeah, you actually can. Vertebral dissection can lead to ischemia or infarction of the cervical spinal cord, so this can lead to unilateral extremity weakness.
All right, with the underlying pathophysiology here, are strokes that result from SCAD always ischemic?
SCAD can actually extend intracranially and lead to subarachnoid hemorrhage. These patients are more likely to present with altered mental status, focal neurologic deficits, and severe headache.
Oh man, even worse with the potential for a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Let's get to the diagnosis with imaging. What's the first line modality?
CTA of the head and neck should help us clinch the diagnosis and guide management. If a patient has contraindications to CTA, such as an iodinated contrast allergy, then MRI with MRA is an option. But ultrasound is unfortunately not going to be helpful for us here because it can miss the diagnosis, especially of the vertebral arteries, which we can't easily see with ultrasound. So POCUS can't be used to exclude SCAD.
CTA it is, and the MRI or MRA is an option if we can't get the CTA, but CTA is probably better for the vertebral arteries as well. When we look at management, what are the major components that we need to think about?
Britt, patients with SCAD but no associated stroke symptoms should receive antithrombotic or antiplatelet therapy to help reduce their risk of thromboembolic stroke secondary to the dissection. They'll need to continue this for 3 to 6 months and follow up with neurosurgery or vascular surgery, depending on the institution.
Is there any difference between the antithrombotic versus that antiplatelet class? And if you choose an antiplatelet, is there any difference between aspirin and clopidogrel?
Nope, no difference in patient outcomes. So your consulting surgeon will likely select whichever agent they prefer. It's important to know that stroke rates are actually similarly low for patients who receive anticoagulation compared with antiplatelets. So don't be surprised if your consultant recommends warfarin.
Perfect. So it sounds like antiplatelets or anticoagulants are the way to go for stroke prevention, but you need to get your consultants on board and let them drive that decision. What if the patient has contraindications to blood thinners?
This is when endovascular interventions come in handy, like angioplasty or embolization of the dissected vessel. Stenting will require dual antiplatelet therapy after discharge, so it's not an option for patients at high risk for bleeding.
All right, let's pivot here. And Jess, does the management of SCAD change if the patient is having a stroke?
Yes, it does, Britt. If the patient has a subarachnoid hemorrhage from SCAD, we absolutely should not be giving antiplatelets or anticoagulants. These patients need immediate neurosurgery consultation and might require therapy to lower their intracranial pressure, antihypertensives, calcium channel blockers, the same things we usually do for subarachnoid hemorrhage. If the patient has an ischemic stroke, we treat it just like usual, even if the stroke is secondary to SCAD. In other words, we should be giving thrombolytics if the patient is within the 3 to 4.5 hour window, they don't have contraindications, and their symptoms are debilitating. They also can't have intracranial extension of their dissection or an intracranial hypertension or involvement of the aorta. It's best to get neurology on board, and you may even need neurosurgery as well.
Yeah, many different decisions to make here. And like you said, get the consultants on board early. Are there any other ED management considerations that we need to know about? How about blood pressure management?
Well, there are unfortunately no clear guidelines on this, Britt. If the patient is having a stroke from their SCAD, we should be following typical blood pressure targets for whichever type of stroke it is. So if it's ischemic, then we'll maintain blood pressure less than 185 over 110 millimeters of mercury prior to administering thrombolytics, followed by 180 over 105. If the patient's not getting thrombolytics, a systolic blood pressure goal of less than 220 should be reasonable. A goal of less than 160 systolic should be adequate for hemorrhagic stroke from subarachnoid hemorrhage, though some consultants might aim for a blood pressure goal of less than 140. Nicardipine or clavitipine are great choices for reducing the blood pressure.
Great stuff, Jess. Let's run through some take-home points. SCAD isn't necessarily common, but we need to have it on our radar. Patients most commonly present with unilateral headache or neck pain, but we can also see partial Horner syndrome or even cranial neuropathies. Stroke is the major consideration here from cerebral hypoperfusion or a thromboembolism. Think about SCAD in younger patients with stroke-like symptoms. Something like unilateral weakness or vision changes are definite clues. The first-line imaging modality will be CTA of the head and neck. For patients who do not have a stroke, treatment usually involves either an antiplatelet medication or anticoagulant therapy. For stroke patients, whether it's hemorrhagic or ischemic, treat them the same way you treat any other stroke patient. Get your consultants on board early. Thanks again for coming on the show, Jess.
Thanks, Britt. I look forward to chatting about more rare and dangerous diagnoses next time.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Stay safe and healthy, everyone.